joining us for a very special episode of Mrs. King's Chronicles. I'm Taya Johnston, and I'm joined by my very dear friends Lexi Fema and Jen Peterson. That's right, just when you thought we were done, we're back. What makes this episode so special? Well, we just happen to have with us the lovely and talented Martha Smith, a.k.a. Francine Desmond. Hello, Martha. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Taya. Thank you. This is fun. Already it's fun.
Oh, good. Welcome to the zoo. Greg Morton has deemed us the zoo, the MKC zoo, and he's a member. So now you have now been inducted as a member. So welcome.
I'll be the giraffe.
There you go. Graceful, long, graceful neck. So I can't tell you how many times we've discussed Francine throughout the 5 years of this podcast, whether it be her hair, makeup, wardrobe, jewelry, or her snarky attitude. But let's just say if you were given a dollar for every instance, you'd be a very rich woman.
Francine, poor Francine. Go ahead.
It's all, mostly it's good. It's more of, why are they putting her in these clothes? And
yeah, same questions at the same time.
And yeah, how much we like your hair in certain ones and how much we don't like it in other ones. So
yeah,
that type of
I
thing.
Know.
Yeah.
I know. People love to bouffant me. I mean, look at Animal House. I just, every time I go in that hairdresser chair, they just go, this would make a fun bouffant. But I think hairdressers just like doing this and that.
Bigger the better, right?
But you talk about Francine and her hair and her character. I do want to stress, because I know that Francine wasn't the most popular. I mean, you guys can sugarcoat it, but I know a lot of people hated Francine. And this is the point. You were supposed to hate her a little bit. Every dramatic show from Greeks on forward has to have the antagonist, the protagonist, and then there's a reason to have a comedic foil. And that's what I was created as, because I was created, my character was created by comedy writers, some of the best, you know, when it comes to Brad and Jeannie from Mary Hartman. And they had that edge about them from the very top. So I think Francine, as much as you should have relished hating Francine, instead of taking her as a real character that was out to destroy your idol.
Right. I will admit, I did. I fell into that camp of, it was more of a throwaway character. Obviously, I was 10 when it started, and so I didn't have much.
No excuse.
But after watching it as, rewatching it as an adult, and then meeting you, I mean, forget it. I mean, I realized, and I started to appreciate the character a lot more than, obviously, I did as a, you know, preteen.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Because you have to have that, otherwise it's all too nice.
Yeah, well, and also there's tension that's created from that kind of a character, and tension is drama, and drama, I mean, otherwise, you know, I mean, even in Mayberry, there was tension, and there were people that you loved to hate that came into the town, so it was just one of those roles that I loved that part of the role, but I know a lot of people didn't like me.
Well, they were, you know, if you were snarky to Amanda, who was, you know, they're, you know, they're number one, right? Wow. That's why. But I've learned since, you know, watching it as an adult, how to appreciate that it made Amanda better, the character better, and made her try harder and all that too, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you. You can be in the defense
room. Good.
Well, Francine was always so put together and color coordinated.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll say that as I've watched it, going through this podcast, just looking at all the outfits, it's been a great walk down, you know, memory lane from the 80s and all those fun colors.
Those shoulders.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Yes. But Lexi and I, especially, but also Taya, have often admired them and said, hey, I'd like to have that shirt right now. I would wear it.
Yeah, especially yeah. Lexi. Lexi's going through an 80s retro thing since she didn't live through them.
Yes,
you got to come over. I'm having an 80s sale of all my clothes.
I have
she would love it.
Oh, no.
80s stuff that I wore at personal appearances on TV and stuff. And I just said, what am I carrying all this stuff around for? I got to get rid of it. So I have all these friends that are the size I used to be. You know, like 0 and 2. And
that I never was.
Yeah,
so,
you know.
Highly sought after, actually.
Yeah. Lots of, I got great stuff. I mean, I have gowns. I have all the crazy things. things I used to wear in my actual real life. I mean, Francine was not a far stretch.
You were very colorful. I was going to say that. You were super colorful looking at, like, the kind of just the out and about, out on the town kind of pictures of you. You really were, like, pretty on, pretty edgy and very colorful.
Yeah, and I was always, I always looked at fashion, not so much now, but then in those days, I looked at it as a way to make people smile. So I can't tell you how many times I would get dressed to go out and whoever I was dating at the time and go, you're wearing that? Really? You're wearing that? Francine was that way too.
You always look gorgeous.
Yeah, that way. Do you have an influence on what Francine wore? And we were also wondering if you'd be able to keep any of that wardrobe for Scarecrow, like sneak it off set or...
No sneaking anything, but there was one outfit I bought that I really liked, and I didn't like a lot of them because I was a younger spirit in terms of the way I dressed than Francine at the time. I was dressing like in little frouncy mini dresses and things, and she was very into St. John knits and that sort of thing. So I bought a, I don't know if you remember it, and I don't know.
We will.
You will. Anyways, it was a red suede jacket with black, like leopard spots, and a red, bright red, fire engine red, a red suede skirt, and underneath it, I don't remember what it was, but it was very expensive. I remember that. And I didn't got
you remember the part that you had to pay for.
And have big shoulders, of course.
That's and funny that they would make you pay for it.
So you bought it for them.
It was cheap. It was expensive. And I think what ended up happening to that was I used to sell clothes to a, like a celebrity resale store.
Oh yeah, you were the Kardashians before the Kardashians then.
And now I got the hips.
That's funny. That's awesome. So Martha, you said you didn't take any of the clothes home, but since the statute of limitations has long passed, did you take any special memento home from the set, or if not, was there something that you wish you would have snagged?
No, I'm one of those people that just doesn't flip things off the set like that. But, you know, when you think about what I would have taken, if I could have taken, probably my name tag, you know, the IFF.
You didn't get to keep that?
No, nothing. Krause takes everything and cleans it up.
Greg has his.
Oh.
Greg got one from DOA. When they did that dream sequence where he was working as an agent, you know, as a little kid, he actually has his.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I'm shocked you didn't get yours.
He already probably, huh? No, I didn't have anything. And I, you know, I barely had the scripts. Oh, my goodness. I had the scripts kind of thrown in this vat in the storage. And then David recently was asking me for the call sheets. I'm going, who keeps call sheets? It's
like, David's obsessed with them.
And I went digging through all this stuff in storage to help him to try to find some. I found like four, you know.
Oh my gosh. I know you don't think about it probably in the melee of everything. You don't think about like, oh, this could be something that I want to keep later on.
No, I'm terrible for that. I'm so stupid in that way. But Jen was asking about the input that I had in terms of Francine, and that's an interesting question because basically I had real strong ideas about who she was in the beginning and what she looked like from what I was reading and from talking to, you know, Eugenie and Brad and whatnot, what the character they created was. So I had created, back when the character got a little diluted and confused, I had created a folder that I ripped all these tear sheets out of Vogue and different magazines. And I said, this is, she would wear this, and she, it was not quite what translated later into the screen, but I gave it a real good try. And I had very little input, and then there, right later on, I think like as we got into season maybe 3 and 4, things got a little better, I think. I mean, I remember wearing earrings that you could have served appetizers on.
Oh my gosh, your ears must have been in pain at the end of the day. We talked about that. They were so big.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I have a mouth like a sailor, everybody knows, and I'm proud of it, too, by the way. So I always want to ask everybody that I meet a lot of times, do you have a favorite cuss word?
Vaffangula.
Oh, my.
That's from my Italian background.
Oh, nice.
You don't want to know.
I'm going to have to look that one up.
No, you've heard that. You've heard that. Go to a few restaurants. Or actually, the other one is from Animal House. It's just the way he enunciated John Belushi, but holy shit!
Oh my gosh,
he did it so well.
He seemed like such a cool, like fun character to be around, I bet. Intense,
so
but
much fun.
Yeah.
Actually, well, my experience wasn't that intense because he was like, he was so gregarious and such a, he's a real people person and
mm-hmm.
he loved to be entertaining on and off camera. So he was always in that mode of like, let's get
trying to make people laugh and
that makes for some fun work.
Yeah,
sure.
I bet.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's cool.
Great,
I always tell myself I should have married a comedian because he could have just entertained me my whole life and made me laugh.
But that's like, you know, all comedy is rooted in pain. And so what you'll find,
that's true.
I love comic people are my favorite genre of people to hang with. But what you'll find is their childhood is usually pretty broken.
Yeah.
And so they find it as a survival tool. Really important survival too, and that's what helps in terms of entertainment, helping other people, is that comedic, that making somebody laugh is a powerful
mm-hmm.
therapy. You
they
know?
Get good at it. I mean,
yeah.
Not that my husband isn't funny, but
I was gonna say that's what drew me to my husband first and foremost was his humor, sense of humor.
Yeah.
Very dry.
Sense of humor is a very good thing to have in life for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you're lucky.
Yeah. Lucky.
Jim's probably hearing you, Jen, and going, what the heck?
He's not here. No, he's funny, but he's very intense. Like, yeah.
Very serious.
I often wish I had a counterbalance of chill humor.
Mine is inappropriately funny at the worst times. Like, just... Like, if you're at a funeral or something, you know, and you're sad or something horrible has just happened, he's always just like, well, you know, like, blah, blah, blah. And you're just like, really? It makes you laugh, but then it also, inappropriate. Yep.
Kate Jackson has said in the past that she doesn't ever recall making a conscious decision to become an actress. It was always there. But we were wondering if you recall when you decided to become an actress and maybe how old you were.
I actually never did decide to become an actress. It might still happen. But I never did, and I'm not kidding. That's the truth. I thought my sister had wanted to be an actress when she first moved to California. I was very young, and I was like 15 when I started modeling. She was looking into acting. I mean, looking into sort of, you know, not seriously. And I thought, silly thing to do with your life. You're going to throw yourself away. You're smart. You know, I didn't see any value. And I was going to go to school to be a shrink. I wanted to be a therapist.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I really wanted to do. I wanted to be a professional. And at my age, that was something new for women to really, you know, bring the career world. It was kind of a new thing then. So I always wanted to do some kind of work like that. But I also needed money. And then my parents decided I didn't need an education after just starting it. So what happened was I wanted to get an apartment. And I started modeling at 15 and saving my money. And I did a lot of modeling. I hated that as much as you could dislike something. It was just not my kind of thing. But I did really well. And so I got my apartment. And then I moved to California with the intention of going to UCLA and finishing my education. And I was modeling in California at Universal Studios. I was doing a record album cover. And I remember what I was wearing. This is 1975, okay?
How?
Record.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what band was it?
I don't know the band.
Oh.
I was wearing a little midriff top that we did in those days, tied in the front, so the cleavage, the midriff, right? And I was in a wheelbarrow being pushed for this album cover. I don't know why, but I was in a wheelbarrow. So we shoot this album. This story does have an end. And the art director, after we were done the shoot, said, hey, I want you to come meet a friend of mine up at Universal up in the tower, the Black Tower, they call it.
Ooh.
And what I didn't know is he was introducing me to the head of casting, who was head of talent at Universal at the time, for all Universal.
Wow.
A man named Bob Slanka. Now, still, it was like, being an actress is a dumb thing. It was nothing I was interested in. So I go in, I meet and chat with him for like 10 minutes, and like an old Hollywood movie, this guy says to me, with no other, this is not Harvey Weinstein, he had no intention, he says, this girl's going to be a big star. I'm like, huh, really?
Wow.
So he takes me down the Black Tower, is this big black tower, and he takes me down the hall, door to door. door, each one that says casting on it, bursts in, everybody, because he's the king of casting, everybody breaks, stops what they're doing, and he introduces me. This is Martha Smith. She's going to be a big star. This is Martha Smith. She's going to be a big star. So I go down all through the universe. I'm just like,
wow.
This guy up to.
No
this
pressure.
Was the day when they had the contract department still. It was just fizzling out at Universal. And what that was, they would groom people. They would set them up with agents, managers, publicists, all of that stuff, and acting coaches. So that's what they did. I got an acting coach. I got a manager. I got a pub. All this stuff was set up.
Wow.
I'm still like going, huh? What? And then I got a bunch of little teeny roles on Universal TV shows, like mostly showing up in a bikini and getting killed. You know, the opening scenes, which I did quite well.
Charlie's Angels. You were in Charlie's Angels and you got killed.
I got killed.
With a little outfit on.
My first six, I was killed every way you can get killed.
Oh, no.
Stabbed, shot, strangled by my lover on the beach. I was all in Universal Death Syndrome. I did that for a while. And then.
Wow.
I was still modeling. And then I get a call from the same man, Bob Lasanga, who I hadn't heard from, just all the casting directors. And I was in Florida modeling at the time, and he wanted me to go to an audition in L.A. here for King Kong, for the lead role, the Jessica Lange role.
Wow.
So this was like not being filmed in a TV show. This was a movie.
A lead,
and
yeah.
I was shooting in Florida. They had brought me there, and I couldn't leave. And so that didn't... Then Jessica got that, and she did well.
Whatever happened to her?
And that was sort of, by that point, I was already in there. And I thought, I go with the wind, you know, and I got blown into acting in that way. And I was really, really blessed, really serendipitous in a way. I just kept getting roles. And
wow.
I never had to, as an actor, although I had other businesses and stuff because of my interests, I never had to have another job. Wasn't one of those actors that, okay, now I have to go be a waitress. Or, you know, I was really lucky all those years. I just always made a living.
Wow.
So,
yeah, that is.
As a Michigan girl, you have two of them here with you, Lexi and I. Yeah, the hand, right? When did you leave Michigan?
1975, I got in my, I don't know what year it was, my big old boat Impala. It was a dark green Impala. I thought it was cool. It wasn't, but I thought it was cool. And I had bought it used from my dad, who was in the auto business. He gave me like a discount on this car, and it had cruise control. So I'm thinking,
wow, that's fancy back then, especially.
Yeah, that was.
I got cruise control. I'm driving across the country in my Impala. So I'm pulling to Beverly Hills in my Impala, and I'm looking around. Nobody thinks I'm cool.
As long as you did.
Yeah, I left 75 and I drove cross country. It was beautiful.
I love road trips.
Yeah, it was so fun.
Yeah.
Wow.
So you said, you know, as an actress, you know, you never necessarily chased work. It happened to come to you. But do you remember the first time you were recognized? Because obviously you've had great roles as an actress.
No, I actually don't think I do remember that. But I get recognized in weird ways. A lot of times it's my voice. Because, you know, like Babs in Animal House, a lot of people saw that, but it was a character. She had the different look, you know, and
sure.
She had the Southern accent. It was kind of fake and made up. But sometimes I get my voice recognized. And then some people will stop me, like, you know, today and say, oh, weren't you Miss July
1970?
Oh, they don't remember that well.
They might still have that up.
Oh, man.
Wow.
The different crowd there.
Yeah. My whole fan base is split up between Scarecrow, you got that like American Pie thing, you know, you got Animal House, you got a bit of the subversion, and then you got, yeah.
I remember when I first met you, Martha, at the Hollywood show, and I David asked me because he was going outside, and he's like, you got to like protect Martha because... There were two dudes that were really into her Playboy persona, and they were a little creepy.
Hey, you know, I gotta say it. It really, there's something funny about fans of Playboy, of Playmates, and it's not funny actually, but it is a little scary.
Yeah,
you tend to get. I mean, I had a few people from Scarecrow that were a little scary, also scary Scarecrow. But Playboy, I mean, I had somebody try to break in my house. I had somebody follow me home from the studio from Warner Brothers.
Oh, my gosh.
They thought I was Heather Locklear, so they got really disappointed.
Wow. That's scary, though.
That is scary.
Yeah, the guy that tried to break into the house. house was I had done a, I don't know what it was, an interview show at my house for some network about, I was on Scarecrow, and they went without telling me and did a helicopter shot over where I lived to show the neighborhood and everything. But whoever that was figured out what house it was from that. They were pretty smart because that was a while ago.
Oh my gosh.
I got a call that day from somebody saying, I understand you like hiking in the area. I like to hike too. I'm coming to see you. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, somebody was on my bedroom deck trying to break in the door.
Oh my gosh. That is frightening.
That's okay. The alarm went off. Whoever it was went away. But it was because of that show. I don't remember what show that was, but
that's frightening. They should never, they shouldn't have done that.
They should tell you where they're going to show your house.
Wow. Wow, that's
I guess
that's
that
awful.
Is the dark side of being, you know, famous and recognized. You have to deal with that.
Yeah, I'm not recognized that much, though, you know. But sometimes the back of my head gets recognized. That's an inside joke.
Okay, well, where is your favorite place to travel? I know you have been to a lot of exotic locations.
Yes,
I've
been to lots of places, and I can't pick one, but I can pick three.
Okay, I will give you three in no particular order.
No, I love them all. Italy for a million reasons. Egypt.
Ooh.
I just had a real heart pull. I've been there a few times in Egypt. I love antiquity and history, and I mean, I was inside the pyramids, and just something there was so magical to me.
Hmm.
As a matter of fact, all of Africa I really am fascinated with. And then Bora Bora was my honeymoon trip.
Oh, nice.
And if you ever want a tropical paradise, that is, I don't think you could outdo that one.
Wow.
That's good to know.
Yeah. I've never been to either, any of those, but we're planning an Italy trip for our 30th, which is
you'll love it.
A couple of years.
You're gonna love it.
Yeah.
Wow. Good eating in Italy.
Yeah, my husband still talks about the pizza there, and I was like, okay. I'm just into the pasta.
You go to these little places in the back alley, these little trattorias, and you just, the food is divided.
That sounds like heaven.
That does sound heavenly.
Well, kind of following up on that, how many languages do you speak?
It's diminishing now. You see, my marriage has cut into my dating life. In a big way. I used to date a lot of Europeans, and that helped my linguistic abilities, but now my Italian's gotten rusty. So right now, fluently, I speak English, French, and I can say maybe Italian if I'm in a, you know, had a few glasses of wine. But in about a dozen languages, I can say, hello, my name is Martha, I'm hungry, I'm cold, I'm tired, and get away from me, you creep!
That one, I bet you needed a lot.
That's
crazy. You can, I mean, I learned German in high school and then I went to Germany and it was too much. The conversational piece, just, it was too fast for me. I don't know how you can do so many languages like that.
Yeah. And Europeans speak a lot more swiftly than German. I tried and, I traveled there. Well, I used to go to watch auctions with my former husband and, they were mostly in Switzerland and in Germany. So I know how to say everything about watches in German, like das ist weiße Masse für Plata.
Oh, das ist gut.
So I was working, but I got in a car accident in Germany and all I knew what to say was, this is a white enamel.
They're probably thinking she's got some head trauma. Oh no.
Did me no good.
Wow.
Where's the bathroom or the restroom would be a good thing that I don't have to say.
Lowest Badensimmer,
I would need that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, or Var so schnell. I remember I did a movie that had, it was American actors. We shot in Italy, so we had an Italian like squad or a team, and it was German producers. So we had to talk to each of these people. You had to go back and forth.
Wow.
I remember had, you know, some German there for just the basic, you know, work things, but... That was all. I don't. German's tough. I tried Danish. I'm Danish. I tried that. That was tough. I got a little Swedish in there.
Wow. My brain doesn't work that well. But that.
I feel lazy because I only know. I mean, I spoke English all through college, and then I didn't use it enough. So now I feel like conversational.
You spoke English.
I just spoke English. Spanish.
Okay.
So, well,
you said English,
sorry.
And I'm like, wait, we're finding something out new about Jen.
Yeah,
I thought there was going to be a good story.
Yeah, I just, I just learned English. No, I spoke a lot of Spanish. I took a couple of Spanish classes in college. Oh. But I to go somewhere and really get into the conversation, and I think you have to just stay there for like 6 months and really kind of get immersed in it. And I didn't
immersion is the best.
So
Spanish, and I could read, but speak.
There's a lot around here. I live in Oregon, so there's a lot of Spanish speakers up here.
Oh, really? In Oregon?
I wouldn't have thought that.
On here.
Yeah, I think it kind of falls on like a lot of immigration in terms of farming. There's a lot of people that come for that and have come for that. So
there's not going to be more farms pretty soon, so you.
Well, maybe only in Oregon. I mean, we've gotten so much rain. I mean, I think the Oregon farms are the only ones that are doing very well.
Yeah.
Only because we got soaked this year. But yes, you're right.
What kept you busy during the pandemic, Martha?
Eating.
Nice. Now I can get into that.
I will tell you, no, I'm not kidding. Eating because my husband, bless him, he decided there was nothing to do. He's a singer, so he couldn't sing out anywhere.
Oh,
so
right.
He said, I'm going to take master classes. Look online, honey. They've got all these gourmet cooking classes.
Oh,
and I'm going to take all of them. And I'm going to use you as my subject.
Oh, that's a good
perfect. 12 pounds later. I mean, I have been the same size since high school. This is one of the reasons I'm getting rid of all my clothes, is because now, after all that eating for 2 years, we call it fattening the curve, not flattening the curve in this house. We fattened the curve. And I had Asian food, I had stir fry, I had Italian, I had French, I had the things he made up.
Was he good? Is he good?
He's excellent.
Wow.
He's so good that that's his new job. I mean, in the household, he's got the cooking, and I don't touch anything.
Jen, he's funny and he can cook.
Yeah, he's a singer. You know, he's a creative guy, and he's a really, really good singer. So, but cleaning up is not his specialty, I will say. That's the one at the dish department.
Yeah, so mine's
that's not so fun.
Mine cooks, and the fridge always has like flour on the door handles. The sink's got crust. I'm like, what are you doing?
Handprints everywhere.
Yeah,
like the cupboards, the doors, the dish. Everything's got those like.
A little, like he's a little kid or something. Yeah, but then I don't say a word because, I mean, he's cooking and I don't have to do it. So it's fine with
that. Cleaning up is fine. I don't mind that. But yeah. Man, he's really good.
Wow.
He's really good.
I'll have to send mine to master classes. That's brilliant.
That's a great skill. I was
that was the lockdown battle for us. It really was just eating gourmet for 2 years.
Wow.
I love that.
I didn't even have a gourmet cook making me anything, and I still gained probably 10 pounds.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did.
Yeah, it was tough. It was definitely tough. So, yeah. Francine, I knew I was going to do that. Martha, what do you see Francine Desmond doing in the present day? Is she still single? Is she married to a prince of a sufficiently sized country? Or what?
Belgium could beat its ass. Francine, I think probably, in my estimation, I was close to her, was married and divorced a few dozen times, maybe. on and off. She tried. There was just something wrong each time. And then she tried a dog, even. She got a King Charles Spaniel, thinking there was some royalty involved in it. And that didn't work either. So she gave the dog to Beeman, who's happily married with six kids, and loved this dog.
That's wow. Awesome.
She took over Billy's job.
That I can see.
And she consorts and consults with him from the other side to guide her in her professionalism so she doesn't let him down.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
And she remodeled the whole place.
Yes.
It needed it.
Ooh, a gym.
Love that.
That's awesome. We've often talked about Billy's office, how he had the weirdest things in his office that we would be like, wait, what is that? It was like a baby Buddha, like half man, half like elephant or something. It was very strange.
That could have been Mel's input, because Mel had a real fascination with Asian culture and stuff. So
interesting. I love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool.
I often wondered about that.
Yeah, we've devoted a lot of time to that office of wondering what the heck that was doing in there and other things like it.
You guys are too. You're so detail oriented.
I know. All three of us are Type A's. Yeah, it's.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, a potent combination with all three of us.
Whenever Jeanette has those reunions and we go back for anniversaries, and then the questions come from you guys. You know,
yeah.
We all sit up there going, they actually know the license plate number.
Yeah, because they use it over and over again. You were a guest star on a few game shows back in the 80s. Are you a competitive person? Which contemporary game show do you think you would be best at?
Oh, a few hundred game shows that I was a guest on. Seriously, I did so many of them. I love doing the game shows. But, yeah, I'm very competitive. In a good way, though. You know, I used to have these Monopoly tournaments in my house, and I would invite all my friends over, and we'd play Monopoly with money. Now, real money, like dollar bills. I got that off of Hefner, who used to play with real money. Only he used hundreds. We used singles. And my friends, yeah, they eventually stopped coming over. I was sort of playing alone at the end.
So imagine that. I love that you're competitive. I am, like, super competitive. I'm a good loser. I hate when I don't play my best, you know?
Exactly. And I can lose too and then be happy and laughing.
Yeah.
But I'm so much friendlier when I win.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I have a hard time understanding people that aren't competitive, like they don't have a competitive bone in their body. It just boggles my mind.
I don't know. Maybe something at birth.
They were dropped at birth. Yeah. It's just. I don't know how they can function and not be competitive in this world, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny.
Yeah, nobody likes to lose in Monopoly.
No.
Tell us more about your exploits in the game show industry.
Oh, I just love doing the game shows. I did so many. And my favorite one out of all of them was Dick Clark's $100,000 Pyramid. It was a super well-produced show with great people to work with, including Dick Clark, who I adored. Hmm. And it was a very well-conceived game. And it took a lot of skill. It wasn't like one of those, you know, anybody could do it sort of things. It took a lot of caffeine to do it, too. But, yeah, that show was just a blast. I did tons of them.
I always watched that one. It was a fun one. It was, you know, not dumbed down at all. And the people were always seemed to enjoy themselves, you know?
Yeah, celebrities love doing it too.
Yeah. You always seem to find your way into the circle, into the winner's circle. I noticed.
That's a competitive streak again.
People probably love being on your side, you know?
Yeah. Dick Clark, he used to make fun of me all the time because I was, you know, as you recall, it was the 80s. So I had the big hair, the shoulder pads, the crazy clothes because, you know, once I got out of Francine's clothes, I got to dress in my clothes, which were even more crazy than Francine's.
Is that possible?
Yeah, that's possible. A little crazy in a different way. And he would make fun of me and he would always go, "What is that? What do you call that you're wearing?" Oh, we had a good time.
That's fun.
Yeah, that show, like you said, that took skill. You know, it wasn't a show that anybody could really excel at. And I did a whole bunch of these other shows that are forgotten and long off the air. But one of them that I really liked was Pictionary. It's actually the name of the TV show was Win, Lose, Draw, but we know it as Pictionary on the street level.
Right, the game board.
That one, I actually got knocked off of because they were giving away too much money every time I played as the celebrity contestant.
Were you really good at drawing? Or was it just, you just kind of zeroed in on it?
Because I played it a lot at home with my family.
Oh, right.
So they just afford giving away all this money. So it was a lot of fun. They were really nice people. But they said, so long. Your guest star days were over in the show.
Can't afford you, Martha. We got to let you go.
Exactly.
Well, if you were to sit down with a group of friends to play a game, which would you pick that you could beat them all in?
Well, I certainly did it with Monopoly enough times, but I have one that I just adore. It's like my family has played it for years and our friends when we get together, and it's called Big Dick.
Okay.
Your mind, come on now. Hey, it's what we do is we get the biggest dictionary. You go could find this huge, heavy, multi-ton dictionary, the biggest one, literally, that takes two people to carry. And you go through it and find all the words that nobody's ever heard of, like a flinger ducker. And you pick a word and then you write down the real definition. Everybody writes a fake definition that sounds like a real one, goes into a big hat, and the person that's the big dick reads them all with a straight face, kind of like poker face, including the real one that's mixed in there. And they try to stump everyone. And it is just, it's hysterical if you have verbal skills.
Yeah, that's the thing. You have to have somebody, you have to have an intelligent friend base, I think.
Right. It's not just intelligence. It's actually just knowing the way things are worded. Like my brother-in-law used to put things like he would just say a small screw and people would vote for it because it sounded
it's
like
so
maybe
simple.
Something of the yeah. It was a small screw.
Oh, I definitely have to look into that one. That one sounds a lot of fun.
Oh, so much fun. Yeah, I lost a lot of friends on that one too, though, I must say.
Yeah, I have some games. I'm not, my family won't play Canasta with me. They've termed it Canasty instead of Canasta.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's
good. So. Yeah, that would be a lot of fun to play that one, I think, too.
But we'll all have to play it sometime online. One big dick tournament.
Yes, that would be.
That sounds fun. Yeah.
That would be hilarious to do. You know, Lexi and I used to work together, and just up until about a year ago. And we would try and get everybody involved, you know, still connected because we were all working from home because of the pandemic.
Right.
And so we started playing online games. We would have like a happy hour. So at the end of the day, like once every couple weeks, we would all get online and do, you know, you'd see everybody's faces and everything. And then we would play, there's one called Code Names. I don't know if you played that one. It's really fun. You probably would like it. It's a lot of, so you have these words that are on the board and there's two teams and actually it's kind of funny because there's a secret agent aspect to it too. So you have these agents and you want to get your team to say the word or words that are on the board that are yours. So there's like a map that shows you which words are yours and which words are the other team. And then there's like a one particular word that no one can say. And if they say it, the other team wins. So you have to be very particular in what you say. You can give one word clues and you give those out and then they have to match up. So you could have like, if there's a grasshopper on the board, you want them to say grasshopper, but they also have beetle on the map, then you have to get them to say grasshopper. So you don't want to say insect because then they might say the other one and you want them to say the one, not the other one.
Oh, okay.
So it's a lot of fun. So we did those types of games like that so that, you know, everybody kind of got connected.
I think we didn't have much, you know.
Yeah, Scrabble. Definitely.
Scrabble was always fun for me. I'd get those X's, Z's, and Y's and make up words like crazy.
Wow. I was never a Scrabble player. We just never played it, but that would be fun, I'm sure, now as an adult to play. Now, Martha, don't you have a game that you also created? I seem to recall that.
Oh, yes, I have a board game that a group of us did in the late 70s. It was also a kind of a Monopoly-styled game. It was with a couple of other friends, and it was a satire on the city of Beverly Hills, which is a funny place, right?
Right, so, right.
It was easy to send it up. And so what we did was we had, for your little tokens that move on the board, we had hood ornaments from Mercedes, Rolls-Royce, Jaguar, etc., Ferrari, you know, and you would go shopping and eating in the establishments of the city and to gain points, but you had status points and then you would gain money. We could buy a new car or another car.
Wow.
And we went to the valley, which was jail instead of
the valley. The poor valley. We had dumped on.
That was super interesting, actually.
What was it called?
It was called Beverly Hills Game, and we had...
Oh, okay.
We actually did really well. We hired a publicist for the first release, and it did so well that the manufacturing plant could not make enough copies. So we had to get start all over with a new board and new tokens, and then it just sort of fizzled. But we did okay. We did okay.
Wow. I believe David found one on eBay and bought
it. David finds everything.
I know, doesn't he?
I don't know. Now he's like, he's Sherlock Holmes.
I know, he really is. He finds everything eventually. He'll look for years.
He's helping me now find an old 19th century house in the south of France that I saw once in the 90s and wanted to know what happened to it. He's like, well, here's the owner.
Oh my gosh. He will too. And he'll get you in there and you'll have lunch there and everything. He's amazing.
I love it. I'm that way too. So
yeah, he's such a research buff. He's really good at it. Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, you've certainly had an eclectic career, that's for sure. You've had so many different, very entrepreneurial spirit, you know,
lots of
fun. Yeah, it's really impressive.
Now we're going to get into some Scarecrow related topics. What I want to ask is, what did you like the most about working on Scarecrow and Mrs. King? What did you like least?
I loved Francine, you know, right off the bat, the way she was created by Eugenie and Brad. And I loved her bite and her sass. And that it was just so much fun to play her. It was like jousting, you know, with Kate, actually.
Yeah.
Which was really, Kate appreciated the joust, too. So it was fun that. And you get to go to work and be a bitch, you know?
That is pretty good. Get it all out of your system.
You come home and you're all sweet and fun, so nice. But, you know, I also really loved going undercover. Every chance I got, I was just so excited when I got a script that let me go into any kind of wig or language or other character. That was a lot of fun for me.
Yeah.
Even being a housewife, going undercover with rollers in my head.
Oh, right.
That was a delight.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. And of course, working with these incredibly talented cast and crew, the best actors, the best crew, the best writers, producers, you know, all that around you.
Mm-hmm.
And then just going to the studio is something that doesn't get old when you're working there and you've got that parking spot with your name on it. There's something really elite about it and also kind of cool. You know, Alfred Hitchcock was over there and so-and-so walked, Grace Kelly walked in here, and you just kind of walking over that same pavement and you feel really kind of magical. It is there.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's really cool that you appreciate it too, because I'm sure there have been a lot of people that have walked those grounds that didn't appreciate it like it sounds like you did.
I couldn't stop appreciating it, and I think what I like the least, maybe other than the long hours, which was not a big deal, is we had so many different groups of writer producers that there was like a little revolving door effect there for a while. So that makes it hard when you're not, you know, they would obviously and naturally be tending to the number one and number two lead and those characters came on board, but when you're third and fourth leading the show, you just get a little bit, we'll just write their lines and not worry about that because we got so much else on our plate, you know. In their defense, it was not easy to walk in and start running a show out of the blue. So continuity would get lost sometimes. Mm-hmm. Francine got a little lost after a while. I didn't recognize her. Mm-hmm. And then I would sort of be used as exposition, which is really... you know, hey, Billy, line four, flee. You know, those kind of lines.
Right. Yeah, season one, you really had such a bite to your character. It was really fun to watch play off the other characters.
That was our original, you know, and they were from Mary Hartman. So that's obviously a real satirical style of comedy that was much different from what we ended up being more. And it, like I always say, it was better for the show. To be more of like a family comedy, adventure, drama, whatever you want to call it. But in the beginning, we had more of that edge that came, I believe, from them and their writing. So it was just a different style. I enjoyed it, but I might have been alone in that.
No, I think you're right, though. I mean, in the beginning, it had its reasons to be there. But then in order for the show to continue, it probably needed to become morph into what it did. Maybe not as much as it did, you know,
right.
That's my opinion, but it definitely, I could see what you're saying though. But
also,
she was fun
style,
then.
That style of comedy that Brad and Eugenie were born on for in the era, that is a smaller slice of the pie of people who, number one, get it, and number two, appreciate it and want to watch it every week. So it wasn't mass audience kind of sensibility.
Yeah. It was certainly fun to watch though.
Yeah.
That was fun to play, too.
Yeah, I bet it was.
And then when that, you know, got lost, I tried to do what I could to to bring her. I was like on a save the whale, save the Francine campaign for a while. You know, and yeah. I took meetings with producers and everybody, and ended up at the head of Warner Brothers TV, all just to say, look, if I can't have any character, you know, I was sitting in my trailer to come out and hand something to Billy, you know, and go back home. If I couldn't do that and say something more Francine-ish, could I get my 3 outs a year to do guest stars? And eventually I got that. It took a little fighting, but I did get to do those, so.
Yeah, I think when we did the podcast, we could tell which episodes. I think we could tell which episodes you were doing those guest star appearances on, because where you were would normally have been that exposition person, it was somebody else that we didn't know that was, you know, in there doing the Francine moments. I think.
Yeah.
And I was like, where's she?
Even the network had called me at one point, and I don't remember which season this was when I was trying to do this, but they called me to do the, you know, the CBS parades. They had Easter parade. Yeah. They called me to do, I don't know, it was Thanksgiving, one of them, and I wasn't let out to do that, to promote the show on the network, its own network.
Wow.
Nothing I was doing at the time. I was literally just doing a few lines here and there.
Was it just a control thing, or did they just...
I don't know. You know, we don't know much at our end of the... But it's all not a silly thing to complain about, because I was really lucky and happy to be working on a hit show and with great people. So, you know, there's that.
Sure. But yeah, you finally are on a hit show, and then you're kind of put on a bookshelf, you know, it only pulled out every once in a while. I'm sure that was annoying.
In fact, Juanita had written that episode, which fell somewhere at the very, very end of fourth season, where Francine finally has a real boyfriend and Francine has a home. She actually has a home.
Yeah, we saw your apartment. Lexi loved your apartment too, by the way.
Oh, okay.
She loves that style.
About that is that script was written quite earlier by Juanita Bartlett and was put on the shelf. That script.
I thought so. I totally thought so.
You picked up on that because you're
I didn't know that was a Juanita Bartlett one, though.
Yes, it was.
That's really, because that's season two then.
Wow.
Yeah, and I got along pretty good with everybody in terms of our producers, but I got along, we understood each other a lot, Juanita and I. She also gave me the double role for Magda.
Yeah, Magda.
Yeah,
you did great in that.
Thank you. She wrote that for me, and it was all time. I had no idea until we actually did it, and somebody sort of whispered in my ear, hey, that script has been sitting around, because we had to do what we could do there at the end when things were not, you know.
Yeah, smooth. With Kate being out.
Yeah, with Kate being out, we had to just come up with something, and that was fortunately all done and ready to go, so we just plopped it in there. But it was an old script. So I was really happy.
So good to know that.
So I had my first apartment. It took 4 years for me to have a boyfriend at an apartment.
And you know, the I would say the fan base is mostly on the not good enough for you bandwagon. That guy was definitely not good enough for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, everybody's like, why is she fawning all over him? We couldn't figure it out.
You know, and Beeman was about the only guy that ever even thought I was cute. So.
Oh, that's not true. There was some guy with some type of fetish thing going on that really liked you too in season
four. Oh, great. Thanks, Taylor. It's really good fetishes, right?
Well, his name was Brady, so I remember it because my youngest son's name is Brady.
Okay, all right. Well,
yeah, I don't like to remember why I what he was about, though. Unfortunately, Bruce Boxleitner has talked in the past about how in the zone he was when he auditioned for the part of Lee Stetson, that he found himself on the roof of the studio building, locked out. Do you recall much of your audition for the part of Francine Desmond?
Bruce should have taken a hint from that.
They didn't want him around, huh?
Yes, I do recall it quite well. I had had three auditions to get to the final, you know, and the first one, it was just very hush hush. It was really just like secret agent work. You know, it was called the Secret Kate Jackson Project. They wouldn't give me a script because it was so secret. So they would give you the sides. But if you don't know what the whole script is, it's sort of, you know, in a vacuum on its own. Mm-hmm. And so I had that and I went to read with Eugenie and Brad, right? The first writer producers.
Right,
and then
creators.
Yeah, they got, and the casting people, I think, were in the room, but no Kate, no Bruce, no anybody. So Eugenie, who I didn't know was also from an improv background, which is interesting, but anyway, she just kept playing the scenes each time with different words, leaving things out, adding stuff in, just little teeny things like that. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange. Usually, I mean, she had the script in her face, she was reading it. So I had improv training, I went along with it, got the second call back, same thing happened. It was Eugenie and Brad. And they kept going off script, and I usually memorize everybody's stuff on a script, just kind of a habit, not on purpose. So I thought, why is she doing this? And then later on, I realized, you know, after that, well, the script was very fluid on our entire 4 years of filming. A script was constantly being revised and edited and things left out, and you did have to work on your feet. You did have to work, and they would. I think, this is my impression, they were just testing me to see if I could do that. You know?
Yeah, if you had the chops for it.
Exactly. So that was all went well. And then I got the call back to network for the screen test. They called it a screen test, but it wasn't really a screen test like they used to do. So it was in this big office building, and there were three girls total. Mm-hmm. And I did not get locked out of the building, however.
That's good.
Like some of us did. And what happened was, though, we the two of them went before me, and it was just an office building, so I was outside the door. I could hear their reading.
I could picture you with a glass up to the door.
Listen. No, I had a little bit of an ear on the door, but I wasn't really crying. I was lying on the floor with my ear at that little crack.
Hey, that competitive nature, that works, man.
All right, you got me, Taya. You got me. So anyways, I did happen to hear both of them, and I heard the response from the network from both of them, which were this nice little polite laughter, like, you know, and I thought, got this, I just know it. So,
awesome.
Went in, and they were really responsive to the reading, and I just felt like, I think, you know, I love the character so much, I love the script, I think I got it.
Wow.
And I know.
And you did. Well, you know what? Probably the confidence that you had, you know, in going, yeah, I've got this. It probably showed through with your Francine, because that's Francine. You know, she was cocky and, you know.
As somebody who's been on thousands of auditions, if I could talk to young actors, I would just say, really, you know, I was one of those that was famous for doing the scene perfectly in the car on the way home from the audition. Flawlessly. But just to go in there and don't be afraid to throw it away and have fun and not just you can keep that stress and those nerves down. It's like watching baseball, the same thing. You watch these baseball players, when they start thinking, they mess it up and go into
overthink things. Think. Yeah. Just commit to it and go for it.
Right.
Wow. Yeah, you know, in high school, I was in an acting class, and I kind of like went out of my own self, you know, like you would do these scenes, and I don't even remember doing them. I had memorized them, and then I would go on stage, and then I just did them, and then it was like another person took over, and then when I was done, I went off, and I was like, did I do okay? I don't even remember what happened, you know?
Yeah, that's it's like channeling. It's a really good way to do it. And acting is a lot like therapy, too, because you go to places like, for example, playing Francine. I'm such a nice person. It was a real stretch to go to that.
I'm sure.
That smart dark.
That would be a fun one.
You get to explore these other sides of your personality and the shadow self and all that. You know, it's pretty useful.
Yeah. Where did you do the improv? You mentioned that.
I worked with Second City here in Santa Monica, and I also had a couple improv groups we used to perform around town. I find it the most exciting form of the art form, but I also, I think, the most difficult to really do well.
Yeah.
Oh, you can flop big time in improv.
That's where you really have to commit, because you otherwise you just feel silly and stupid and just, you know, you come
out. Yeah, I'm good at feeling silly and stupid.
No, I bet you that probably helped you know, all those different components that you would learn, it probably really helped you nail it all.
Oh yeah. And back to that getting Scarecrow. This is really funny. I was literally in no man's land because I was going through a divorce, and I had been out of my home for 5 days before I got that show. When I got the call, so 5 days I had all my money was tied up in another project I was working on. I was broke. I had a roommate sleeping on my couch. I was doing whatever. I couldn't even have furniture. I didn't have a TV.
Oh my goodness.
So I had just moved into this place. There were still boxes. My clothes were in wardrobe boxes. And then I get this call. You know, it was amazing.
Who do you remember who called you? Was it like your agent or? Huh?
My agent.
Your agent.
Was, you know, like when the dog hears walk and everything else is la, 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 la.
Yeah. You heard got it and you were done.
I heard got the part, and then he went on and on about the contract, the terms, the billing, the credit, the this, the that.
You're like, just la, whatever. La, 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 la. Wow. How exciting that must have been. Especially when you're in, you know, somewhat dire straits.
Oh, yeah. I had all my money. I had started this card business, and I was on a soap opera before Scarecrow. So Days of Our Lives. And I had taken those earnings and started this greeting card company. So all the money was in a warehouse full of cards and envelopes and things that would not pay rent, right? It's my new business. I never thought I was going to get a hit TV show. So there I was, really nervous, 5 days into a new home. And I got a starring role on a TV show in a few days after moving out. It was just blessed.
Wow. It's just like timing's everything, you know?
Yep, totally.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's super great. Do they make a greeting card for that? Congratulations, you just got a starring role on a TV show.
Yeah, side note, I have to tell you, I was cleaning out my office, and somebody had sent me old VHS tapes. They knew, you know, they know I archive all that stuff, and they were a Scarecrow fan as well. And so they sent it to me, and I was going through just to see what was on there, to see, should I burn it on a DVD, you know, that
you
kind of thing.
You have a VHS player?
Yeah, I do. It's like a combo. It's a burner. Burns onto the DVD. So I was watching this tape, and there's an interview with you, and it was in the 90s, and you're talking about your real estate work, and then you are talking about the card business, card business.
I ended up selling it all off to a jobber, all the inventory, when it just got, like, I didn't have anybody run it anymore, and it was,
yeah,
how funny.
Yeah, I'll burn it and send it to you.
I'm so impressed you have a VHS, though.
Yeah, if you have anything you need burned, let me know, because it's probably one of the few that are still out there. That's crazy.
When I first started working as an actress, we used to have, they were called the 3/4 inch. This was like the professional tapes that you used, you would get your work on, these big, heavy bolts.
Okay.
Yeah, they're huge. And at the time, my ex-husband, he was, you know, sort of in the business, and he had 3/4 inch players at home and all that. I got these things. Now I got boxes of them. I don't know what, but some stuff is really, some good old stuff is in there. Like,
oh, I bet.
Yeah.
I've never heard of that.
Yeah. 3/4 inch. It was a big, much larger format than the VHS.
Wow. That's funny. Well, I'll get it off there and send it to you. And the card company, I remember it having a funny name, a cute name.
Tickled Pink Ink. It was called Tickled Pink Ink, and that's still my corporation to this day. I kept it.
That's adorable.
Yeah, that's a great name.
Yeah, everybody likes it.
So, if you go back to past June 1985, what advice would you give yourself?
Stop perming.
Lexi loved your hair permed in season 2.
Yeah, stop the perming, especially if you're colored at the same time. Keep the call sheets.
Yes. David would love that.
Keep scripts in good shape and take some of the clothes. You know, things like that. Right? I know. People do love stuff from film and television, which you never know when you're shooting something that might later on be somebody's joy to have.
Mm-hmm.
I never at least. least I never thought about it. And I remember just recently, I realized I had Babs from Animal House. That was my character.
Yeah.
I had pink shoes with the little bow on them and the teeny prince's heel. I had those for years and years until recently I did a big purge and I think I threw them out. I was so mad.
An Animal fan, Animal House fan's going to hear this and be like, no.
I'm still hoping that maybe there's somewhere hidden.
Maybe.
That's
some retirement money.
But you know, that would have made someone super happy. Those are the ruby slippers of Animal House.
Yeah. Oh, people would die for that stuff. Yeah, mm-hmm. I collect a lot of scarecrow stuff, so I do know how that is.
It's amazing. And my scripts are all raggedy and old, and I used to, you know, I lived at the studio, so you would write down your to-do list on your script covers and stuff.
Oh,
so I've got, like,
funny.
You know, things that I buy at the store and who I have to call or where I'm going out for that night.
Oh, that's so fun. David and I would be drooling over that stuff.
Oh, David loves that. He loves all that stuff.
Oh,
he does. Whoever thinks somebody wants.
Yeah.
Oh,
I do have a few of those, and I know David has even more than that, so yeah.
I think out of all those shows, I kept like four or something.
Oh, wow. Yeah, it's always interesting. I mean, I just always found it interesting. David uses it to be like, okay, where is this location? Because he's so into those locations.
Oh, I know, yeah.
Yeah.
But as far as advice to myself, again, you know, back to that question.
Yeah.
What about that? Seriously? I don't think I would have done anything differently from those days. I was really super busy, probably a little too busy, because I was throwing in travel every chance I was offset.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, doing usually one or two businesses in the show and then personal appearances. And I was really dating a lot. So all that weather probably was burning a few candles. But other than that, you know, I think it was a really good time and
that's
well
good.
Played.
That's good. It's good that you don't have any, you know, regrets and, you know, you're content with how everything played out, you know?
I avoid regrets like the plague. I think it's really no use for regrets, is there?
No, not at all. I agree.
No.
I agree. But some people, it'll haunt them. You know, things will haunt them till the day they die. So that's good that you
did. Yeah. I got enough exes haunting me. I don't need anything else.
That's funny.
What advice would you give someone else then in that position?
Going into television work or something?
Yeah, back in 1985, someone getting on a hit show. Would it be the same stuff you identified for yourself?
I think I would tell them you've got to keep your head screwed on. If you're going into the business of Hollywood or anything that involves fame, really, you know,
mm-hmm.
whether you're an artist, a musician, a sports person, if you don't have your feet on the ground or people around you, they're going to help keep your feet on the ground. I was raised in the Midwest, as you know, and you are. And we have that. We have that sort of naturally. There's something about the Midwest and people.
There is.
That.
It's very true. Yeah. Yep.
We like dealing with each other in business, too, because you know you're not going to get all that, you know. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
there's the East Coast, then you have the Midwest, and then you have the West Coast. you can tell when you're in business who you're dealing with.
Yeah, so if you're going into showbiz, you want to at least get some of those people around you. Just don't have all the yes people there because that's not going to help you.
Right.
The yes people, they glom onto celebrities, and that can get really into a surreal type of existence where you don't know anything that's going on anymore.
Yeah, it's dangerous.
Fame is a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
And I didn't have great fame. I had just a touch of it, but I did know a lot of greatly famous people that I spent a lot of time around. Just the way my life played out, I knew a lot of people, even from politics, from show business and different fields, and I saw so much damage from it to people's heads, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I would recommend people that get into it, first of all, just make sure they stay grounded. And stay off social media, which is its own form of, I can be famous because
yes.
I have my phone here and everybody loves me suddenly. I'm getting all these thumbs up about how people are.
Right. That they crave it. They can't go on if they don't have that.
It's the dopamine feedback.
Yeah.
Move, and then the developers know that. And that's why they don't even let their kids on it.
Yeah.
So it's something I say, you know, don't get into that trap. And yeah, and then the other thing I would really say to women going into it is don't identify with your beauty if you are in fact a beautiful, you know, mm-hmm. consider that character and role that you play. It's a trap also that will hurt you down the road. And I don't mean that's, oh, you're going to lose your looks and you're not worth anything.
Mm-hmm.
But the industry has a way of sort of making your currency about that if that's how you started. If you start out as an ingenue that's playing the bikini roles, you know, which I got killed in a bikini about 15 times when I started.
Yeah.
Whether it works or a bikini girl, I don't know.
Wow.
So you don't want to get up to 40, 50, 60 and start, you know, pulling your ears back and, you know,
eventually. God, yes.
A distorted face, and then you lose touch with what is your value? What do you bring to the stage or mm-hmm. the screen? In general, it's such a trap. So
yeah.
Stay with people, you know, that are going to just support you for who you are and keep developing yourself on every level and just let that one fall like a rose wilts, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I wish more women today would, like, age gracefully instead of
yeah.
turning into these, I don't know, non-human function, you know, like people that you just don't even recognize anymore. Just
the worst is here in LA. I mean, I think this is the worst place in the world.
Oh, I can't even imagine.
Yeah, Europe is better. The East Coast doesn't seem as bad, but I think also, again, those reality shows changed a lot of people's perceptions of things. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing real in a reality show.
No.
There's nothing real on most of those people's faces.
No, it's scary. I mean, they get to a point where they're just frightening. You know, it's uncomfortable to look at them.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Oh, I don't understand that. I'd much rather look at a woman who's, you know, got her wrinkles and just growing old gracefully, you know, like look at Helen Mirren and
yeah.
Meryl Beautiful. Streep. And, you know, they look natural, you know.
And in their defense, you know, if you do want to persist in the industry, you're going to have to. I mean, I never done anything, and I never really wanted to be an actress. It would just sort of happen. But in their defense, a lot of them that do want to make a living and continue working have to do little nips and tucks
yeah.
along the way
yeah.
because unless they want to be consigned to playing somebody's grandma with two lines in the background, you know.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think it's changing with more women writers, more women directors and producers. It's changing.
Yeah. But yeah, that's you're like, right. They, in order to continue doing what they love doing,
right?
Otherwise, they have to completely change. And there's not a ton. There's definitely more parts out there now for older women, but it's a young person's game for sure.
Yeah, they were camera friendly, and they yeah. want, you know. And the thing is, it's just about what you think yourself of yourself. It's
right.
you behind you, and for a woman. We are, most of us, raised with those fairy tales of, you know, if you're a beautiful woman, the knight on the yeah. white horse will come take you away and your life will be perfect.
Right.
And all these lies. And it's really good to break out of that as early as you can and stay, again, grounded.
Yep.
Stay grounded.
Yep.
I'm like an earth person and I'm not.
No, but you're right. And I think, like, even, you know, tying it back into the show, I think, because when we've interviewed Greg multiple times and then also Paul, you know, we commented both of them that they're just nice men. Like, they grew up appreciating women, respecting women. They didn't get into the drug scene and the party scene. It's just, I think, because, and they attributed it to that they had, you know, a strong family uh-huh. around them to you know, yeah. keep them grounded, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we
yeah,
certainly know there's a lot of people that didn't have that around them and, you know, had a rougher go of it.
When I worked for Playboy, I met a lot of the girls that worked there, and there was a lot of sadness in those girls. Mm. Not the generalization, of course. But what I noticed was in the younger group, as things, you know, back when I worked for them, it was, you know, 1903.
Oh, stop.
And it was all just kind of like innocence, you know, it was the girl next door.
Mm-hmm.
But as time went on, I noticed that a lot of them were what I call the daddy-less girls. They were broken homes,
mm.
they had divorces, and they didn't really have a father figure in their life. And
yeah.
So what I think happened, this is just my conjecture, is that it drew them to later go out of their way to draw attention for men, any men. It didn't matter
right.
who. just to have men just look at me. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the first way get that attention.
Get some fake boots and take off most of your clothes and they'll look at you. I don't know if that's what you want them to look at.
Yeah.
So that's the sad part too. And so like you said, the family is where it all starts. The family, if you get a good supportive family, but you can't always order that, you know?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's the luck of the draw, right? just in regular everyday life.
Friends and they'll teach you.
Yeah, there you go. Run a family. Run a grounded family.
We're just about a year away from the 40th anniversary of Scarecrow and Mrs. King, and yet we're still talking about it today. Why do you think this show has endured as long as it has?
I know.
Francine's earrings, I think. Just a guess. People tune in and talk about it. No. I think it's pretty obvious that show... the relationship that was created between the two leads, you know, between Kate and Bruce and in the writing and then on screen, their work together. I think everybody wanted to keep seeing more of it. And there's a nostalgia of that kind of the romantic comedy love style. Mm-hmm. There's a nostalgia that brings people coming back. And there's an innocence that was maybe... just at the edge of the end of an era of innocence.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I think as a country, our innocence started getting broken back in 1962 with Kennedy assassination. But then, of course, there was Watergate and things later that, you know,
started eroding it, yeah.
But still, at that point in the 80s, we, if you look back, that show was a bit of a glamorized version of things with, these touches of reality just enough so that it wasn't total fairy tale, you know?
Sure.
So, yeah, I think there were simpler times back then. And so people cling to that because it makes you feel good. You know?
Yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
We had our enemies that were the Russians then. And just about the end of the show, they started becoming a little bit more Middle Eastern, I remember.
Yeah, yep. Season 4, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, definitely... the type, the love, you know, will they, won't they, won't they, aspect of it, something that drew people. But you don't see the same type of fan, I guess, love from the fans for the other shows like it, like Moonlighting and Remington Steele and Heart to Heart and those type shows. They have their own, but they're not doing, from what I can tell, they're not doing like the anniversary events and things like that where
I think
the chemistry is between Kate and Bruce, and then, you know, the outer cast too, you know, all of you guys just made it, and I said it before, like to Greg and Paul, like you can't remove one person and put another actor in and be like, oh, it's the same exact show. It wouldn't be the same, you know. You guys were perfectly.
I think the casting was done.
It was perfect.
Yeah.
Just perfect.
But you're the one who could answer that question about why it's endured so long, because like you said, we have the most ardent fans. I remember, I think it was the first reunion or whatever you call it, anniversary show, where people were coming from crazy places, Australia, Germany, Belgium. An old TV show.
It's crazy. It's just crazy. I was 10 when the show started, and so
me too.
So you know, it's fully embedded in my childhood. You know, it's been my number one show since I was, you know, from the debut of the show. You know.
Aww.
And it's just, and there's nothing on I don't get into TV shows nowadays, and I hadn't, you know, in the 90s or 2000s or anything like that either. It's just this one particular show. It just, I don't know. And depending on the day when you ask, it'll be, you know, the chemistry, and other times it's, you know, the will they, won't they. It kind of varies. You know, my answer varies, but it is. It's just something, there's something just magical about the show that I think just... and why we've done the podcast and why people listen to the podcast, you know.
I think you have to go back at the end of the day to Kate and Bruce, because even more than producers and writers, honestly, the basic storyline was good and all of that. But I mean, there was a reason Kate was the number one TVQ actress for a long time.
Yeah.
TV, as you know, yeah. So, and Bruce, of course, has his own particular charm.
Yes, he's not too bad to look at.
Yeah. So, and then you mix it together, and magic happens, and there you can't hold it down.
Yeah.
Where I can have that with, like, nothing against Sybil Shepherd.
Right, right.
Start at the same time, but Kate can fly off the screen with her audience and her heart.
Like sucks you in, yeah. And the two of them together was just like dynamite,
yeah.
You know.
You just get lucky. That's that lightning bottle.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right.
But then Francine's earrings help.
And of course, Francine, you will have to send over the for season three. We did a special. MKC awards. So you received a few awards for some crimes against fashion and
oh great. No.
Not that you had anything to do with it. It was fun to do though. We all recognize how much of a badass the character of Francine Desmond was, and especially given the time of the series back in the 80s. Did you realize then how you portrayed the character would influence young women growing up watching you?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think I actually did think about that because, before when I was first getting into all my modeling and acting work and everything, it was during women's liberation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we got up to the 80s, there was more of an accepted women in careers and professions, and that was sort of, Francine was a professional, but she did attain a very high level at a very important organization, right, which was never named.
Yeah, at a young age, too. I mean, relatively.
Yeah, relatively,
yeah.
10.
Yeah.
At that part, you know, I probably related to that, you know, consciously, but I don't know, when I think of people watching Francine and everything and what were they picking, I really didn't have a clue because the mail we would get, the fan mail, wasn't really dealing much with that. You didn't get young girls. But I would love to think that, you know, future CIA agents were watching.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Or whatever organization and wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I know for me and I know for the other ladies that grew up with it, you and Kate were like, you know, what we strive to be, you know, like not necessarily wanting to go into, you know, CIA work. I think Miranda, our other partner who wasn't on tonight with us, wanted to be that, but, you know, you can still carry it into your career, you know, being in business and, you know, kind of being that badass and not being afraid to just speak up and, you know,
yeah,
not be that fragile female.
Exactly.
You know,
I never played girls well anyway, so I got that woman that was not afraid to push herself ahead there. So yeah, that part was fun.
Yeah,
but and I actually wasn't so bad with my automatic weapon.
No, not at all. Not at all. You were quite good. Mancine, did some great fighting for you as well.
Mancine, that's my stunt double, right? I guess they ran out of women that week or something.
I guess. I mean, goodness.
I had my cut or something. I never knew.
I mean, even Kate's sometimes was pretty rough, you know.
Yeah.
And then when
yeah.
we get down to the third and fourth, you know, leads, it's like, oh wow, they weren't even trying then.
I know you weren't supposed to notice. I remember one time they wanted me to drive. They got me a car. Francine got a car. It was a big deal, but it was a stick, and I don't drive a stick.
Oh.
And so it was like. We experimented with that for about 12 seconds and decided, no, we're not going to do this.
A Midwestern girl, you don't know how to drive a stick?
I know, but Detroit.
That's crazy.
That's right.
That's funny. So finally, I'm going to name an actor from the series and ask you to tell us the first thing that comes to mind about that person. So what comes to mind when I say Greg Morton?
Okay, so that one's pretty recent because I didn't work with the kids too much on the show,
right.
You know. We were usually on different...
You were Magda with them.
Yeah, right. Well, he's got, you know, right now he's got his full big beard and everything.
Yeah.
So we had our last anniversary event we did read-throughs, table reads of some of the scenes written by the fans at the last event. So that was really fun. And he was playing himself as a little boy in these scenes, and it was just so funny.
He was really into it.
Oh, no, it was so funny already without even, you know, trying. So when I think of Greg, that comes to mind because that was, I got some big laughs out of him at that. So I would say, ha, is the first thing that comes to mind.
He is, he's a character. He is so fun.
Yep.
He is so fun. What about Paul Stout?
Ah, CIA. Just between you and me, I think he really does work for the CIA. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
He's behind the scenes conjuring up, you know, nobody knows this, so just keep it quiet between us. But he'll disappear every now and then. You just don't know where
he's.
You can't find him. Sometimes decades, he just disappears.
It's all coming together. All the pieces are coming together because, yeah, you're right. He is very secretive and aloof.
He's in a weird place with some new perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, and he's lived such an eclectic life too.
Yes, and he's smart and he's secretive, and I think he's actually a real agent.
I think you might be onto something. We might be blowing his cover. Oh, that's awesome.
I can totally see that.
And then what about Mel Stewart? Didn't you two share weren't you guys roommates of sorts?
Trailer nights. Yeah. We had you know, the trailers that you sort of spend your day in there. We had one long one that was connected. So when I think of Mel, who was a very, very strongly passionate man with a big heart and strong will, strong opinion, strong everything. And playing that saxophone in that trailer next to mine, which is very thin walls, right? I mean, it was good. It was fun, but I was always playing my kind of 90s alternative rock music. Packed jazz. So that's, I love Mel. He was wonderful.
That's awesome. I actually played the alto sax for like 4 years or something. Not as well as he could.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah,
so
back in...
Lots of steps. I'm learning things here about you.
Yeah. It didn't last too long.
Yeah, I was like my flute playing.
Oh, you're a flautist.
I took my flute lessons in high school, and I kept going to the class saying, my parents are going to buy me a flute next week, and I never bought me a flute. So I learned the guitar.
That's so funny.
I couldn't take to the flute class. And so then I finally got my flute like in the 70s, late 70s or 80s. I think it was late 70s. I finally got my flute and learned how to play.
Oh, that's awesome. Do you still play?
No.
No. I had my saxophone and my kids were like, you don't know how to play that. And I'm like, yes, I do. So I went to the music store and I'm like, I need some reeds. And they're like, what kind? I'm like, I don't know. It's for an alto sax. Like, how many are there? Oh, there's like, all, I'm like, just give me all of them. I went and played it. I played it for him, and then my lip was swollen for like 2 days because I wasn't used to it.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
Have that problem. You just kind of...
Yeah, the reed, it just... Oh, man, I had a blister on my upper lip for a while.
Oh, I'll show you.
Yeah. Well, they go, okay, you do know how to play, but... Not very well. Beverly Garland. She just seems like she was just...
Oh, I love her.
Amazing.
I love her so much. She just touched my heart. Her and her whole family. She has great kids. Her husband, before he passed, I mean. And we got together. She used to invite me over to parties at her house. And she's just wonderful. I can't say enough fine things about that woman. She was really good to me. She helped me out, you know, and she gave me a lot of good advice as an older actress, you know.
Yeah,
she was great. She said, take any job you can get after you get of a certain age. Anything.
Oh.
She was doing soap operas and weird roles, like kind of a, I don't know what she was doing, something like Vampiric or something. But was a great hostess, really funny woman.
Mm-hmm.
And what in one word, huh?
Oh, no. She just seems like she was just a no-nonsense, you know, cut right to it and tell it like it is kind of person.
She was, yeah. She was a lot like that, and that Dottie had in her character as well. And she really She was a fellow Libra, you know, a few days apart, our birthday.
Yes, all of you guys, all three of you women are all in October.
Well, Kate is a Scorpio, which is quite a bit different than a Libra.
Yeah.
But a little bit later, yeah.
Yeah, she's at the end.
Beverly and I just, we were kind of vibrated on the same level a lot. Yeah. So we really loved each other a lot, yeah. Oh, I actually wrote a screenplay, I didn't tell you this, I wrote a pilot for a TV show that was going to be three generations of a family in Chicago. It was Beverly was the grandma. It was three women. I was the middle, and then I had a daughter.
Oh, wow.
Daughter, and Beverly was kind of like the hippie grandma that was like a yuppie, or no, not a yuppie. I was the yuppie. She was the hippie. And she was going to protest and everything. It was a comedy, a half-hour comedy. And I took it to New Line. They loved it. And they wanted to hire me to write for them, but they wanted me to write a romantic comedy film, which is not what I was writing.
Mm.
And so, but Beverly liked it. I wrote like a show Bible in about four episodes, you know. So.
Wow.
Didn't ever happen, but it was an idea.
That's too bad. That's unfortunate. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, it was fun.
Maybe what's old is new again, maybe.
Yeah, well, we don't have Beverly.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be putting that 50-year-old, 40-year-old woman right now.
Yeah, yeah. What about Bruce Boxleitner, big old Bruce?
Which one was he?
He's a cute one.
With
the dimples.
Scarecrow, that one.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, he was Bruce. Bruce and I were like comrades there, you know. We used to go to the commissary for lunch and commiserate about things, but he was great. When I think of Bruce, I think cowboy.
Yeah.
I think debonair leading man, you know, good looking, funny, and he gave me hell on the set. Only West, right? Just joking.
Yeah, like brother and sister relationship.
No, he looked out for me. He and Gary are stunt coordinator.
Yeah.
I know when we went to Europe and I happened to be dating a few German guys over there. They were looking out for me, literally like big brothers would, you know?
Yeah, that's nice.
They only beat up a few people.
I do recall there was a story where they got in a fight at a bar. Yeah.
That sounds familiar.
Oh, that's great. And then, obviously, Kate Jackson.
Oh, yeah, Kate. Well, the smart one, right? Isn't
yeah.
She's no. And she, wow, man, think of the pressure. Starring in your own TV series, producing your show, mm-hmm. owning half of it, right? And even directing some. I mean, there's so much to do for her. And yet she was capable of getting all that. And plus, then she got sick in the end.
Yeah.
Poor health. So she had her hands full. And I think she certainly, you know, raced to the bar and she loved it. But she was very involved in the writing. And she had really high standards of what she wanted to see. So mm-hmm. she wore all these hats, and it was not easy, I don't think, for her compared to everybody else.
Sure.
I mean, we just flew in and did our scenes, you know. We weren't thinking, well, how much is this trailer costing this week, and what are we going to do about the producer's budgets and that kind of
yeah,
thing.
That's
so
true.
I think, you know, I really love her, and I want the best for her. She's hard to reach. We have gotten together several times recently, but not recently enough. So I'm due to try again.
Yeah.
She's a fragile, she seems really like she's strong, and she is, but she's on the inside very fragile.
Mm-hmm.
I think she needs a lot of love.
Yeah.
And I give her some love.
Yeah.
Kate has, obviously, because of the status that she achieved in television and everything, she has special qualities. People, audiences pick up on it, and when you meet her, you pick up on it too. And she has a fragility and a human quality that makes you just want to hug her and care about her. I love her, and I wish the very best for her.
Mm, that's very sweet. And on that note, we'll say a heartfelt thank you to our amazing guest, Martha Smith. It's been wonderful to hear your insight into the series and get to know you better, listening to your eclectic career of all these different things that you've done. You've touched in everything, it seems like. Thanks also to our listeners for coming along for the ride. We hope you enjoyed this special episode of Mrs. King's Chronicles. Until next time, bye.
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 Bye-bye.